Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. China threatened the U.S. with grave consequences if Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. So now what? Let's get to the bottom line. For China, nothing matters more than restoring its place in the world as a great power. It was put on mute for centuries, but now it's rich, it's armed, and it's back in a really big way. Its only peer rival is the U.S. One of the top obsessions of China's leaders is to reunify all of its territories and squash any rivals. And one of the biggest thorns in its side has been Taiwan, which many people believe should be a fully independent state. Thanks to Henry Kissinger and an American policy called strategic ambiguity, Taiwan exists in a purgatory. It has self-rule, but China always threatens to take it back, while Washington says it's committed to the status quo. Now one of America's top politicians, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has visited the island to underscore its autonomy. So is the American commitment to Taiwan about to be tested? And what are the repercussions of a showdown between the world's two biggest powers? Today we're talking with Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University and author of, most recently, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Dr. Walt, thank you so much for joining us today. I guess I should start out with the news of the day. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has gone to Taiwan. She has done what a lot of folks advise her not to do, including the Joe Biden White House. I guess this was on her bucket list before she left the role as speaker, perhaps. But I know that you see the international system in very deep, nuanced terms across the way. But what is this pinprick to China mean to you, and what do you think comes of it?
A couple of things. I mean, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. What I think has bothered many people and bothered the executive branch here was that it was a largely symbolic visit. It wasn't connected to any particular strategy we have for managing our relationship with China or dealing with China as a potential rival. And in a sense, it was a symbolic step that was nonetheless a real red flag to Beijing, and an issue that they, you know, made it very clear they were going to be very unhappy about at a moment where the Chinese are dealing with some leadership issues, an economic slowdown. And I think the thing that worried people most about this is it's happening at a particularly inopportune time where the United States is already deeply immersed as a supporter of Ukraine and its war with Russia. And the last thing the Biden administration or indeed the world needs is to raise the temperature in Asia. If you were doing that with a clear strategic purpose, you really knew what the purpose of this was, how it was going to alter the relationship in some fundamentally positive way from an American perspective, that might be one thing. But this seemed to be almost a vanity project on the part of the speaker. And it makes me wonder a little bit about the degree to which there's coordination between, you know, two parts of the Democratic Party, the people on the Hill and the people in the executive branch. You would like to see on foreign policy issues them working together rather than working at odds with one another.
Well, there's also a piece to this which often gets neglected, and perhaps it's the wonkiest part of it. But the making of foreign policy is, according to the Constitution, as I understand, typically a function of the president and the executive branch of government. The Congress, the legislative branch, has advice and consent roles. It's supposedly the place that a war is declared by Congress. But the making of foreign policy is a function of the chief executive of the U.S. government. Is Nancy Pelosi trying to outflank President Biden and trying to make foreign policy in this case in a very unusual way?
I don't think so. Certainly, if that's what's happening, it's not the way our system of government is supposed to work. I'm all for the separation of powers, and I actually believe it'd be a good thing if Congress played a more active role within its constitutional boundaries. The problem is that if this trip causes problems, if the Chinese decide to do something in response, it's not going to be Nancy Pelosi's responsibility to deal with it. It's going to be Secretary Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin and the president and his national security team that are going to have to deal with the fallout from this particular issue. So again, I can't quite figure out what Nancy Pelosi thought she was going to accomplish here and how it was going to help the fortunes of either the president or the Democratic Party going forward. That's when I say that it's not, doesn't appear to be connected to any particular strategy. That's what troubles me most about this.
Well, let me play a soundbite for you of a question posed to the president.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made. That's the commitment we made. We are not. Look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We've signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate.
When the president made that statement, it seemed to be really quite different from what our stated policy on Taiwan is, which is one of strategic ambiguity that we neither accept that Taiwan can be taken by force, nor do we give, I guess, current to the notion that Taiwan can be independent from China. Can you tell me what you think U.S. policy is with regard to what the president said, what Henry Kissinger crafted, and what Nancy Pelosi's doing today?
Right. Well, ever since, Henry Kissinger crafted this Shanghai communique back in the early 1970s, the United States has had a rather, as you said, ambiguous policy. We've wanted that issue to be somewhat fuzzy. We recognize that there is one China, but we also say that we don't believe the status between China and Taiwan should be resolved unilaterally by either party. In practical terms, that means we don't want China to do anything to force Taiwan to be controlled by Beijing, particularly anything militarily. But we also don't want Taiwan to unilaterally declare independence from China. And this forces the United States to engage in, let's say, a certain amount of, you might call it double talk, you might call it ambiguity. So the president says what appears to be a rather unequivocal commitment. If there's military action, we will fight. But of course, the rest of the administration then walks it back in the subsequent days, leaving it again fuzzy. The United States clearly wants China to think that it might come to Taiwan's assistance because we don't want China to move unilaterally. On the other hand, we don't want to make such an unambiguous commitment to defend Taiwan that encourages Taiwan to engage in provocative behavior that might, in fact, provoke the kind of attack from China that we want to deter. So I think, we're inevitably going to be in this kind of gray area where people occasionally say things that signal a greater commitment, and then we say other things that suggest, well, there's still maybe a little bit of fuzziness there as well. I do think it is a mistake, as former Secretary of State Pompeo and others have started to argue, that the United States should abandon strategic ambiguity and make a clear unilateral statement that we are going to defend Taiwan under any and all circumstances. First of all, that is a very provocative act from Beijing's point of view, and they're likely to respond to that. But second of all, it could encourage Taiwan to do things because it's so confident of American protection that actually destabilized the situation.
Look, I want to be clear to my audience that while we're talking about China today, I don't participate often in discussions that try to silo the United States and China and their relationship away from everything else in the world. And so what else is going on in the world? Well, there is a ongoing mess in Ukraine, and the United States has been working hard to try to keep China from weighing in on Russia's side in that equation. We have big climate change challenges coming up that are talked about. There are global economic issues that are being discussed all the time. There is North Korea and its basically stated intent to launch a lot of new intercontinental ballistic missile tests and trying to use China's influence there. So I guess my question to you, Steve, is the complexity of dealing with other issues and China's points of leverage that it can use to put pressure on the United States and what the opportunity costs are of this Pelosi trip potentially.
I think you've put it really nicely. I mean, we ought to recognize that as the two most powerful states in the international system, the United States and China are going to eye each other warily, not just this year, not just next year, but for a long time. We're going to have to manage that relationship. And each side is going to, on occasion, look for ways to gain advantages, whether that's in high technology, whether it's in building diplomatic influence, whether it's influence in international institutions, whatever. It's going to be a fundamentally competitive relationship. But as you suggest, it is a complicated world, and those two powerful countries also have reasons to try and collaborate with each other. First of all, it's good for our economies if we can continue to trade and invest with each other. That's good for Chinese economy. It's also good for ours. We have climate change as a shared interest along with the rest of humanity. We have a whole series of other places. North Korea would be one, possibly some issues involving the Middle East, where China can be helpful. And as you suggested, we certainly don't want China going all in backing Russia's war in Ukraine. So even though it's a fundamentally competitive relationship, we also have big incentives to try and manage that relationship in a way that advances American interests. I believe, and I've written in a forthcoming article with my colleague Danny Roderick, that what we really need is for China and the United States to start basically grouping their relationship into four different categories. Actions we agree we're not going to undertake towards each other. We're not going to try to promote regime change, for example. We agree on certain things should be prohibited. Another bucket where we deal with issues by mutual adjustment. We compromise in exchange for them compromising. You could think of arms control or trade negotiations in that category. A third category where we act independently to protect our interests, but we try to do that in a rather calibrated way. So if China is doing something that affects our interests adversely, we respond to it, but we don't escalate, and we expect the same behavior from them in response. And then finally, those areas where we have to cooperate with others as well. You need multilateral solutions, and climate change is the perfect example here, where lots of other parties have interests there as well. I think that would be a template or a roadmap for putting different parts of the U.S.-China relationship in different categories, cooperating where we can and recognizing we're going to compete where we have to.
Look, the opening chapter of the Biden administration's foreign policy was the so-called pivot to Asia and these kind of tough encounters. I remember one in Alaska, and, you know, these various meetings involved Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. And the real takeaway is they were sort of photo ops showing how tough we were in the United States and that we really meant business and that the relationship was going to change. We saw Kurt Campbell, another leading figure in the National Security Council, to Biden doing this. And then all of a sudden, Vladimir Putin over in Europe saying, hey, remember me over here. So I guess my question to you is, how would you grade the Biden team thus far in managing the complexities of global affairs, but also keeping its eyes in the right place and weighted in the right way when it comes to dealing with the complexities you just laid out with China?
Yeah. You know, maybe B minus.
So that well. You're giving that good a grade.
Well, I'm considered a harsh grader. I mean, I do think they have not lost sight of China as the major issue as well. And in a sense, they get a better grade this week than I would have given them 2 or 3 weeks ago, in part because they were finally able to get Joe Manchin on board with some of this legislation. And they've been able to advance the idea of actually an industrial policy that will maintain American competitiveness in the chip industry, which I think is really actually critical to maintaining, parity with China, not immediately, but in the years ahead. So that, I think, is good evidence that they are, in fact, keeping their eye focused on the China problem. That said, they certainly did manage to get themselves, heavily distracted by a number of things, most notably the war in Ukraine, which I don't think they did enough to try and head off in advance without realizing, what the consequences were going to be if the war ultimately broke out. And I think Biden's recent trip to the Middle East was also something of a distraction from the more critical relationship with China. It didn't really accomplish anything positive for the United States as well, and burned up some more bandwidth, some more presidential time. So again, I don't think it's been a disaster. What's missing, as I've said before, is the sense that the administration has a clear, well-articulated, integrated strategy for dealing with China, which of course also involves an integrated strategy for dealing with all of our partners in Asia. What they've done so far on international economics, of sort of bolstering those trade relationships, is not very substantial and not as ambitious or as successful as the efforts that China has made to build economic relations in that part of the world. And, you know, that's what I would like to see the administration start to develop going forward. I would rather see more low-level Pentagon officials flying with no publicity to Taiwan to talk about defense cooperation and bolstering Taiwanese defenses, then I would like to see the Speaker of the House flying there for a symbolic photo op that gets a lot of attention but is not substantively important.
Well, you know, one of the things that interests me, Steve, is the vulnerability the United States now has as a superpower to having moments of where it creates a defining moment about its what it considers to be values it must defend around the world. And that ultimately, whether it's geography, and well, you wrote an article, real, you know, talking and commending Taiwan on many, many fronts, but one of the things that had not changed was its geography, exclamation point. And then in this, we have the equivalence of something that I would call a Suez crisis. People can go back and look at how the shift in global perception of power between the United Kingdom in the 1950s and the United States happened around a crisis in Egypt. I'm just wondering whether we are at risk in some of these values battles around the world, be it Taiwan or Ukraine or elsewhere in the world, that other powers call our bluff, call the America's bluff, and it's very hard for us to actually deliver on some of these commitments that we have made. What's your view on that?
Yeah, well, I think it highlights the need for not just, you know, mechanics who know how to run the foreign policy machinery. And I think they're the Biden administration, you know, experienced group. They can turn the crank and make our foreign policy systems work. What they need, though, are architects who see a larger picture and see the connection between these different different conflicts, different commitments we've made, different obligations or different goals we're trying to pursue. And let me give you a perfect illustration. It seems to me that the war in Ukraine, although that has galvanized enormous attention and led the United States to move away from the pivot to Asia and once again sort of recommit to Europe, sending more forces there, putting a lot of time, attention, effort, and weaponry into that particular conflict. From a broader perspective, what's happening in Ukraine is actually a signal that over time the United States should be shifting towards Asia and letting Europe deal more with its own security affairs. Because what are we learning from the Ukrainian crisis? We're learning that, first of all, Europe really did neglect its own defenses and had to rely on the United States once again in this case. But we're also learning that while Russia might be aggressive, potentially dangerous, it's also not that powerful. It's not so strong that the Europeans lack the wherewithal to deal with Russia if they choose to. Now, this is not a shift that you could make overnight, but an architect looking at this situation would say, this is now the time for the United States to begin to really press its European partners to take more responsibility for their own affairs, because they really can do it, not immediately, but over time. And that will allow the United States to shift attention to Asia, where the Europeans really don't have much of a role to play, and the United States is absolutely essential. That's the kind of bigger strategic shift I would like to see, but I don't see any evidence that that's happening right now. Instead, you're seeing just the usual reflexive, you know, invoking of all of the familiar tropes of transatlantic solidarity, and NATO is all important, and the United States has to be the first responder in every corner of the world. And I don't think that's necessary. I don't even think it's feasible any longer.
Well, you speak to groups all around the world, and I think one of the interesting questions out there, we talk about the revival of NATO and, you know, how we're all for one and one for all and stronger than ever and focused on, you know, it's like history has come back again. But after January 6th, domestic instability, the rise of white supremacist violence in the United States, I'm just wondering how solvent our allies think our commitments are. How solvent is our promise to be with them in their dark days when they see how internally divided the United States is right now?
Yeah, I think that many of our allies around the world still want American protection. And they work very hard at persuading us why that's important for us to provide it to them. I mean, I think that's a decision for us to make, not for them to make. But there still are definitely, you know, strong instincts to try and get America on your side. That said, there's no question that countries around the world have some reservations now or concerns about the United States, driven not so much by what we're doing in one part of the world or another, but by what's happening here at home. Because the country is so polarized on foreign policy, because Donald Trump was so unpredictable and so willing to pick fights with friends for no good purpose, other countries have to worry that if the White House changes hands in 2024, you get the pendulum to swing back another 180 degrees. Barack Obama can sign a good nuclear deal with Iran. Donald Trump can tear it up. Joe Biden says he wants to get back into it, but hasn't yet. Another president could then tear up any agreement he made. And other countries cannot adjust and couch their behavior with an expectation that the United States will fulfill its commitments if our political system is causing us to go, you know, go up and down like a seesaw every 4 or 8 years.
You know, I know that you're a big believer in American engagement in the Asia-Pacific region. You believe it's a way to keep China focused there. Taiwan is a key part of that, as you just described, about having discussions about how to arm it. But how do you think the Taiwanese people feel with regards to watching what happened in Hong Kong unfold? And is there an element there that we should be made, you know, that we should be sensitive to, at least in terms of over-promising to Taiwan?
Well, I think that what happened in Hong Kong actually was very short-sighted from Beijing's point of view. I mean, I think that there was a possibility 10 or 20 years ago. You could imagine Taiwan and China gradually and voluntarily unifying over a period of decades. The Chinese economy serving as a big magnet. There was lots of trade and investment going on between Taiwan and the mainland. And you could have imagined if Hong Kong and other special areas in China had sort of maintained their autonomous status, that reuniting would have looked pretty attractive to the Taiwanese maybe by 2040 or 2050. And so this whole process would have happened peacefully and voluntarily on both sides. I think the crackdown in Hong Kong has now made it almost impossible, if not impossible, for Beijing to offer Taiwan any kind of special status, any kind of autonomous role within a unified China that the Taiwanese are going to believe, because those promises could always be rescinded at some point down the road. And I think it has actually reinforced the Taiwanese desire to remain on their own for as long as possible. So if, in fact, reunification was the goal of the Chinese Communist Party and something that Xi Jinping has set his heart on, what has happened in Hong Kong has actually made that more difficult rather than easier.
Well, as usual, I feel like I'm getting a snapshot of grim optimism from Dr. Stephen Walt. So thank you so much for joining us today and for your candor.
Great talking with you as always, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? My guest says China and the U.S. are going to be at it for a very long time. And I have to agree. There are going to be times when these two great powers cooperate and things will look sunny, only to suddenly give way to gloom and doom for one reason or another. That's because these two superpowers will never fully trust each other. By the way, it has nothing to do with ideology or that one is a democracy and the other an illiberal communist state. What really matters is that huge things that have to be tackled on the global scale, like nuclear nonproliferation or climate change, natural disasters or transnational crime and more, none of these can be done without the active cooperation of both. Pelosi's trip to Taiwan will put a dent in the relationship, and there may be real harm to Taiwan and to the interests of China and the U.S. after this trip. But these nations will survive to fight and cooperate another day. And that's the bottom line.